Blog Talk Radio.
To tap in the Arkansas Paranormal Network, coming to you from Van Buren, Arkansas. Hoping everybody's having a great day. This second day from New Year, or the first day from New Year's Eve, or second day from New Year's. Hope everybody will have a great New Year's. And please don't drink and drive. We don't want that to happen. Anyway, the title of the show today will be Haunted Places in Alabama, which is not going to be what we're going to run. Now, I'm going to run the show that I was supposed to run last night here. For some reason, I could not on here last night. So I will be running that show here today, and on the Facebook stuff, I will be running the Haunted Places in Alabama. So I'm going to have two different things going here at once. So I hope everybody enjoys the show on this one, and we'll make some announcements because this little program is not quite 2 hours long. So I will be making more announcements at the end of the show. So everybody enjoy. And this was the show that I was doing last night, supposed to run last night. It was called Crop Circles Are Not Man-Made. And it's a pretty lengthy little clip that I downloaded about this documentary. So everybody enjoy this.
The first part of this talk tonight is going to be about the scientific work that has been done on the crop circles primarily, and particularly the published scientific results. Then after the break, I want to get into some more, I can't say more interesting, but some more modern, some more current stuff that's going on. I'm going to briefly talk about the discoveries in the cattle mutilation situation, some UFO trace cases and the results of those examinations, and then this most recent trip that I've taken to Europe this fall, where amazing things occurred involving, of course, Robert Vandenbroek. And I'm going to talk about him and the growing awareness that I have that consciousness plays a role in all of these things, and furthermore, that there's an interrelationship that crop circles, UFOs, out-of-body experiences, poltergeist activity, etc., that these things are interwoven, are interrelated somehow. At least that is my growing impression. So, if we can have the lights off, can you all see? Because this is about where I have to stand.
I can move again.
I'm sorry. Briefly, BLT stands for Burke Leavenworth Talbot. This is the name by which we became known back in the very early 90s when we started. John Burke, and we have a photograph, is a New York businessman and was very interested in electricity and electrical phenomena. He became aware of the crop circle situation at about the same time I did, and both of us learned about this guy Leavenworth, William Leavenworth, who was a biophysicist who was in Michigan. And John and I had exactly the same idea, which we went to Michigan and knocked on the door and said, "Hi, my name's John, my name's Nancy," to find out what he was doing. Here's a picture of Lefty. It was clear from that early work that he was doing, went to the lab, we looked at exactly the process that he was using, and realized that this was actual science. He wasn't kidding, he was actually doing absolutely normal scientific methodology, and he was coming up with results. It was formations like this that had gotten me interested, and in particular, the Mandelbrot set, which absolutely stunned me that a formation of this sort could appear in the field. I saw these myself, before I knew anything about them, as an invitation, rather like a calling card, that the British leave, or the upper-class British leave in trays in the vestibules of big mansions and houses, announcing that, you know, "Hi, I stopped by to see you." That's how they hit me and made me think that there was a great deal more to be learned and instigated all of the work that I've done since. Here we have, I guess you know this guy. If you don't, that's Reuben Uriarte. In England, this is Danny Lobb, and that, of course, is Silbury Hill. They're doing some sampling there. The way the BLT work has been done is by sampling plants and soils in the crop circles and also outside the crop circles for controls. A sample to us, a plant sample, involves a hunk, say 15 plants or so, cut off at the base. The soil work we were doing in the beginning was simply surface soil. Now we do some other things, but back then it was surface soil. And we would take hundreds of these samples inside the formations and then also outside. Here's a bunch of these samples coming out of the field in England. That's a very small portion of one formation sampling. Here in Holland, this was in one of Robert's cases that I was sampling myself, just to show you that all the plants in Europe have to be dried down because of opportunistic molds, which have to be gotten rid of before the plants are shipped. And so sampling is an expensive procedure when it's overseas. It's not cheap here, but it's much more expensive overseas because you have to rent a barn or a facility of some sort in order to dry down these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of plants, as well as soils, because it's very expensive to mail the soils when they've got a lot of moisture in them. In those early days, before we really knew much of anything, Leavenworth didn't know what to look at. He had many ideas. One of the things that he noticed pretty quickly was that the knuckle-like protuberances, the nose on the plants, seemed to be showing changes. And so he originally thought that if he took slices of this node tissue and examined them underneath the microscope, he might see differences. What he found were these enlarged cell wall pits, these tiny little black dots, which occurred in the sample plants but did not occur in the control plants. And at first, he used that as a parameter, one parameter, of an indication that this was not a man-made event, that this was something else. The microscopic work is very tedious. He, in the not too far distance, not too long after that, discovered that other parameters, much easier to determine, were the ones that he started to use instead, and that was in particular this node length change. This is from a sample from a plant from a formation, and this is a control node. Now, this is a very extreme example of about 200 and some percent, but you can clearly see that those nodes are of different size. What we found most consistently around the world in crop circles, literally taken from about 17 different countries now, is that this apical node elongation is the most reliable finding that we have physical result that you can see with your eyes. The apical node is the top node beneath the seed head, And here we have the formation plants, and here is a batch of controls. It is also a mistake to think that when you have node elongation, you must also have node bending. This is not true, as this example ought to clearly indicate. The node elongation can happen totally independently of node bending.
Trying to run audio and video at the same time, which I know it may sound a little crazy, but with Sling you can do it.
Bending. In this formation in England, about 95, East Meon, the sampling diagram shows you the samples were taken directly across in both standing and down crop. The white here indicates the down, the gray is the standing crop. What we found in this particular case, and this is not typical of all crop circles, unfortunately they vary considerably, but in this case, this is node length, and these are the sample numbers this way. All of these red bars indicate increased node length in all of the downed, the flattened plant samples. In the standing plants, we did not find node elongation. You might think that would be typical of all crop circles, but it isn't. The formations are a lot more complex than that. I mean, this is found frequently, that the flattened plants will show the changes, the standing don't. But in many of the standing parts of crop circles nowadays, we see the same changes in the standing plants. We not only found that node elongation occurred in the plants, we discovered that this node change would be distributed in many cases as a function of distance. In this case, let's say we're sampling right across, or let's say even better, from the center to the edge. What we found is that the node length decreased from the center to the edge as a function of distance. In other words, as each sample was taken farther and farther out, the node length decreased. And furthermore, it did it in conjunction or in accordance with a law of physics known as the Beer-Lambert principle, which describes the absorption of electromagnetic energy by matter. And it does so, it's a mathematical formula. Here are some examples of the application of that. In this case, we have a flat center in the circle going to the edge. In this case, we have a standing upright center, and then the flattened beginning here going to the edge. And here in this case also. When you get this fit with the Beer-Lambert, what the Beer-Lambert principle predicts, what you know is that that physical change is related to the absorption of electromagnetic energy, not boards and planks. In Holland, 99 I think this was, Robert, looking on this is right on his back balcony, observed a pinkish-purple light ball which came in over the field from this side and became stationary at this spot. It then opened up, flattened out into a disc-shaped pinkish purple light, and he was very specific, it was not a craft, it was a pinkish purple light from which an energy was discharged down to the crop surface. When I asked him to try and explain what he meant by energy, he said, like the shuttle. What he meant was the fire that you see when the shuttle takes off. Then the light disappeared, the boom was gone, and he could see that the circle had opened up. It turned out within a couple of days that another one happened. In this case, there was a flash of light, literally just a flash, like a flashlight going off, and the second one opened up. And a little bit later in the summer, back in that corner, a third one occurred, where in the daytime he saw simply a sphere of brilliant white light come in and hover over that corner of the field and creating a third circle. When this first one happened, I didn't have any money and I thought I couldn't possibly get there, and yet I had to get this thing sampled. He saw it occur. It was much too good. The property is very close. We know the farmer. And so I called Elcho Hasselhoff in Holland and asked him if he would carry out the sampling for us. I told him exactly what we needed to have done. Here are the diagrams. I wanted them sampled in this radial way, and how many samples and where to take the controls. And he said yes, he would go ahead and do it for us. Unknown to me, he had already apparently decided that that he was going to do an analysis himself. Now, I don't mind that he did this. I do mind that he kept the damn samples for as long as he did. But it turns out that maybe this is very interesting because he completely independently of Levengood documented the same kind of thing that we've been seeing for years. What he found, and he did it by computer, this is how he did his measurements. Levengood does them by hand. Elcho thought that this would be a better way to do it, and so he devised a computer program and did it by computer. It turns out that both of their results are exactly the same. But what he came up with, he happened to pick an incredible crop circle to start with. This thing had these very distinct changes on either side. This is one diameter, another diameter, another diameter. What you can see there is that the node length changes from the center to the edge are more or less the same on each side of the diameter. You see? But notice that each one of those diameters is different from the others. They're not the same. What in the world can cause node length change along one diameter that is independent and different from the node length change in another one? This was one of the more amazing results that we've ever seen. And Elcho, again, unfortunately, did not. He had promised to, once I found out he was doing all this, to not release his results until Levengood had time to do his work. And the idea, I thought, would be to release the information together. I thought it would be much more powerful. He couldn't contain himself, and he went ahead and jumped the gun. And this unfortunately infuriated Levengood, and so Levengood's report was never made public. But in fact, I have that report now. He did find the same physical changes in the plants that Elcho Hasselhoff documented. From the scientific point of view, that's actually pretty good, because we had no contact with Elcho other than asking him to do the sampling. So he did his work independently of ours and came up with the same sort of result. The major difference in Hasselhoff's interpretation is that he, taking Robert's information of this pink-purple light ball, figured out from these node length changes that the height of this ball of light jived, in his opinion, with the radiation disbursements. And so Elcho decided that the ball of light, in fact, had caused these node length changes. Levengood applied, again, the Beer-Lambert principle rather than the particular mathematics that Elcho used. And Levengood's opinion is that Elcho's doesn't hold up, that in fact the Beer-Lambert principle is more applicable, and that therefore the ball of light may have been an adjunct to whatever actually delivered the energy. This is a fine point, and I don't think we really care. The point is more that something was delivering these radiation intensities to the plants, and two different scientists on different parts of the globe were able to document this, and their documents jive with each other. Now, I mentioned before that we find in standing plants the same changes.
Would you and Teddy like some tea?
Teddy and I would love some tea.
I'm having a tea party with my friends at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. St. Jude freely shares our research and discoveries to help save kids with cancer everywhere.
Do you like a finger sandwich?
Of course. Who fingers?
Give thanks for the healthy kids in your life and give to those who are not. Donate now at stjude.org or shop where you see the St. Jude logo.
That we find in the flattened plants. Not always, but in some cases. In this one in Oregon in 97, we did control lines going away from the formation and this way. And note this randomly bound stuff, which is important here too. And what we found here was not only the Beer-Lambert application worked again, but it did so in the standing crop. This is the crop out in the field that's normally called controls. If, in fact, planks and boards, of course, are what are caused, or how crop circles are made, how in the world do you explain these changes, electromagnetic changes, or these changes caused by exposure to electromagnetic energies in the standing crop? The second most reliable physical change that you can see with your eyes is this. These are expulsion cavities, and this is one type. There are a couple different types. Here are the controls. There's the case itself. I think this is actually from that particular circle. And here's the more typical. This is what you see much more frequently. Both of these changes in the plants are thought to be, by Levingood and many other people now, due to exposure of the plant stems or the plants to microwave radiation or something that's working just like it. Something is heating up the moisture inside the plant stems, causing that moisture to turn to steam instantly. It's a very brief, very intense burst of heat. The steam then has to escape. At the top of the plants, the tissues are soft and pliable. They stretch easily. Consequently, the steam seeps out and leaves this elongated stretched node as a result. Farther down the plant stem, what you get is this. The steam builds up. It cannot escape, and it eventually blows a hole right through the nodes. Now, in the early days, we found these only in, occasionally, and only in the second node beneath the seed head. Things are changing nowadays. This particular formation, a couple of years ago in England, near the Adam and Eve stones, had expulsion cavities all over it, all over it. In addition, it had very massively elongated nodes. So when people tell you that these changes are found only in simple circles, think twice. Here's another case in which I found both. This is in southern England, the Vale of Pusey. Here's a case in Germany where there, again, these are samples taken from these formations here. In Belgium, the same sort of thing. These are their plants, their photographs. The point I'm trying to make here is that you see in them all over the world exactly the same things. Every country I've been to, when I examine a certain number of those crop circles, visually, the only two things you can really find that are scientifically documented is this node elongation and the expulsion cavities. The other things are done in the laboratory, and you really can't tell in the field. Now, when this particular formation occurred at Windmill Hill, Barbara, do you remember the year of that?
2000.
Good girl. I love these people can remember all that. When this occurred, I mean, by now we're hearing a lot about, oh, it's all made by people, this is planks and boards and yada yada. And when this thing occurred and it came on the connector, I was sure that if there was ever a crop circle that was man-made, it had to be this one. It's all, you know, rectangles. This would be easy to make. I asked one of my field workers in England, because I try very hard not to go with any prejudice I have, to go in it and report back, and he did. And what he found were massive numbers of expulsion cavities. They were literally everywhere. And extreme node elongation again. I absolutely could not believe my ears when he told me this. He happens to be very thorough, very competent, and very low-key. He would never say anything like that if it weren't true. So I was fairly certain it was true, but I couldn't believe it. I simply could not absorb that. At the time, I again didn't have enough money to get over to England. I was certain that this one had to be sampled. And so I asked him if he would please do a few samples anyhow. I had to have some samples from this. And he went ahead and did do some sampling and got some controls. I didn't know where he'd done this because I hadn't told him to do anything in particular. He knows basically what the format is. Well, a couple of days later, one of our backers heard about this and sent me the money, and I was able to go. And I gathered together a crew of people, and we went into this again with that same guy and several others and spent 3 days sampling it carefully. Very interesting that at the end of that sampling effort, I think I was there only 3 days that year, I had $50 left. I had, you know, a ticket, you know, to get out of there, but I had $50. Dan, who's my guy in England, it doesn't have a great deal of money either, and he wanted very much to go up in a helicopter and just see some of that year's crop circles. So I gave him the $50, which is enough for him to get a seat on a helicopter. And we finished this formation at 10:30 one night. I was leaving the next day. In fact, I was heading towards the airport, I think. He went up in the plane. He was over this thing at 8:30 the next morning. And he said he almost fell out of the plane because at every single location where he had taken the original samples, and there were only maybe 10, 11, 12 of them, and perhaps six controls, at every single one of those locations, it was now a brand new circle. They had not been in that field at 10:30 the night before. No one except Dan knew where he had taken the samples and the controls, because I was in such a hurry, I didn't have time to talk to him about that, and I had just established a sampling line based on my own instinct. Now, as conservative as he is, and being in England and knowing that quite a few of them are man-made, I mean, he just simply was astounded. I think it's what turned the tide for him. And all I can think when we talk about consciousness is that something did that for him, because no one else would have recognized that as significant. That same year, we also did this one, and this one also. Again, if there was ever going to be a man-made one, I thought, oh my God, it's got to be this one. Again, expulsion cavities everywhere, massive node elongation. So a lot of my ideas were getting shattered left and right. It's important to notice that some of this energetic situation seems to be increasing in intensity. We get an awful lot of crop circles in corn here in North America and in Canada. This is, what, 10-foot tall, 11-foot tall field corn up in Canada where we get it all the time. In the early days, we would find occasional expulsion cavities, occasional. What we're finding now, and it did occur in this one here in California, and also in Canadian crop circles, but we're finding massive expulsion cavities, not just in one node, not just in two, not just in three, but in 8, 9, 10 nodes all the way down the plant stem. In this formation, that was the case. And in this one, both of these are from Canada, from BC. And we found these all over the place. I went up to do this one in Quebec a couple years ago, and it was also the case here. It takes an enormous amount of energy to heat the moisture up inside one of these plants. They're tall, they're big. And to see these holes blown all the way down is really something. It's also interesting, in this particular case, there's some very unusual lays that have been occurring in corn. Here's an example. It's laid from the center directly out, a radial lay. In this case, as if a bomb had been dropped right in the middle of it. Here's one of the corn stalks from that particular formation. There's another one up there. There are about six on this particular stem. And they looked just exactly like that. We're also finding something else in the corn which is a little disturbing. This is a break, or we're calling them cuts, at the node. It happens to be down very close to the ground. There is a condition in corn, in field corn, known as brittle snap. And brittle snap is a disorder, it's a disease, which occurs in certain hybrids when the growing season has been particularly wet during a very critical point of growth. Then subsequently, bad storms occur, and you get these snaps. But you get them at the top of the plant. In brittle snap, it never occurs down low. Furthermore, it can only be in these certain hybrids, and only if the weather conditions are a very precise way. That has not proven to be the case in these that I'm going to show you, where not only are these breaks occurring, you can see here it's right down close to the ground. Here's another one. In some of these cases, it will be in every single plant inside the formation and not one single plant outside. If it were brittle snap, the entire field would be affected similarly. We find that this is not the case. This is the lay. This is another.
Optimize your post-production workflow using Sling Studio. From smartphones to professional cameras, all connected wirelessly and recorded to a single location. The possibilities of great life stories are now limitless.
Circle in corn, I think this one is in Holland, but this is a typical spiral lay, and here are two that are quite different. In this case, we have, it's, these are both in corn, the lay is from the edge into the center. The plants were all laid into the middle. And here's the one in Ontario. in Quebec, where they're going from the center out. These are very rare. You don't see this sort of thing very often. And this we've only seen once, and it was in 2004. All of the plants, and this is corn, are laid horizontally in one direction. I've never seen that before. This case in Illinois, a year ago, I guess it was, also, it was again in corn, fascinatingly, the two circles, a little teeny one and a much larger one. This is the radial lay that we discovered in the smaller circle. And there's a photograph of it, again laid from the center out. But in the larger circle, it's much more complex. We have here an outer ring laid clockwise in this area, counterclockwise in that area, covered by a radial lay. Never seen that before either. A brand new situation in whatever's going on in circles in corn. This is a photograph of that where this is one of the breakpoints where the plants are aligned this way and this way around the edge, and then all the rest covering it in a radial lay in the middle. In that formation, we also found a number of these breaks, again, down low in the very lowest nodes, not in the upper nodes. That's just a photograph up close from that formation. The next major result in the scientific work of Levengood's were the growth changes, the growth abnormalities. What we find is that seeds taken from crop circle plants, regardless of when the crop circle occurs, early on or later in the season, those seeds tend to be smaller, they weigh less, they're dehydrated, and they often look as if they will not germinate. This is in wheat, and here we have the formation, and here's the formation, here the controls in corn. Normally, we see this, in fact, we always see it early on in the season, as in this formation, or this one, both of which occurred relatively early on. And when these seeds are germinated, this is what we find when the formation has occurred early in the season, before the seed is fully formed. This is, you got a massive retardation of growth habit. Those seedlings, in fact, most of those would not survive in the field had they been planted in the field. These are the controls growing absolutely normally, and those are the ones from the formation. And this is a consistent result when crop circles occur early in the season. This would be May and June. Sometimes it's a little bit into July. Now, once the seed is fully formed, talking here mid to late July and August in the northern hemisphere, as in this formation at Littleberry Green, what happens there, also in this one at Milk Hill, is that the seeds, again, although they're fully formed when the incident occurs, the seeds weigh less, they're shrunken, and they look as if they're not going to germinate. But what they do is germinate faster, up to five times faster than normal, than the controls. They produce greater yield, and they do it without light or water for long periods of time. Now, that particular result is, of course, of great interest to anybody in the seed business. Levengood had a very strong interest in this arena, and some of his earlier work had suggested to him, I mean, he'd been working on ways to improve seedling vigor and growth, and he thought he had an idea as to how that occurred, what sort of energy was causing that. This is the sample that made us really do the work, or made him do the work. This is from California, a circle in grass, at the ranch of a guy who appears to be an abductee. Levengood had done this work and had taken the samples he needed from these plants and then put them into a box, put them back in the box they'd come in, and thought he'd thrown them out in the incinerator. In fact, he had not, and he was cleaning up the lab more than a week later, 8 or 9, 10 days later, and discovered that all of the samples were green and vigorously growing, although they'd been in the pitch black dark by that time for 2 weeks, and had had no water at all. As you can see, the controls, they were all like this, were dead as doornails. That gave him a lot of impetus to go ahead and do this work. And he and John Burke then collaborated for several years on refining this idea that Levenkood had had originally. John, who was very interested in electrical properties generally, started to go to things of this sort. This is a rock chamber, an Indian rock chamber in New England, and he visited many of these. He also went to a number of other ancient sites. And what he was looking for was certain magnetic anomalies, which he began to discover in relationship to the doorways of the pyramidal structures, the beehive structures. And over and over and over again, he would find a very distinct anomaly in a very distinct location relative to the beehive dome or the pyramid shape. Furthermore, he photographed repeatedly plasma discharges inside these chambers. Subsequently, he would take seeds of a type that was indigenous to whatever country he was in. In this case, it was Karnak. The dolmen in southern England were examined. This is Cahokia. He went to Tikal in Guatemala. And he did these tests in all of these places, and it took a number of years. But what was eventually discovered was that we could produce exactly the same effects in seeds by exposing them to these very precise locations at the Serpent Mound, at Cahokia, at Tikal, wherever, as long as he had figured out the amount of time. It took quite a while to figure out how long you left, what kind of seed, and exactly where did you put it in order to produce these changes. That was enough information so they were able to refine all of their ideas and produce a piece of equipment that delivers electrical pulses, a very precise electrical pulse to perfectly normal seed. Again, there's a very specific period of time, and it took quite a while to figure this out, but they were able to produce regularly, reliably, this sort of change, where you have a massive increase in growth habit, much more rapid growth, greater yield, meaning there are more seeds produced, and they do it without water or light for long periods of time.
What about people?
What about people?
Do they get invigorated?
I have no idea. We didn't test that. They probably do. This is an advertisement that John put together for a company that he and Levenkood formed, trying to market this device to the seed companies of the world. Many, many independent studies were done by universities all over the United States and Europe, in Japan in particular, but also all over Western Europe. These studies produced exactly the same results, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of a 25 to 35% increase in yield and increased resistance to drought, lack of sun, or bug infestation. Here we have a carrot seed that was treated with this piece of equipment, and here are the controls. The seed companies got exactly the same results, but they didn't buy it. Now, John says he thinks that the reason that this was not picked up, he's a bit of a cynic anymore, was that the number one, the seed companies have invested massive amounts of money in genetic engineering. Number two, the technology in this particular case is very simple. You could not charge a lot of money for it. And in fact, any enterprising farmer who can now go to the internet and get the patent right off the internet could probably build the damn equipment him or herself. And so the thought was that this was never promoted, at least John thinks, because they couldn't control it. And yet without in any way affecting the environment, without hurting the bugs, the bees, the butterflies, the birds, anything, it does nothing, this process, other than strengthen that particular seed. It seems to me like a much wiser move than genetic engineering, but I'm not in the billion-dollar seed business. But I have a feeling that he may be correct in why that wasn't picked up. So if people do say to you, why do you bother to study things like crop circles? This is only one small indicator of what can be learned by actually studying these phenomena we don't understand. John has written a book in which he discusses much of this work, along with his larger vision of why ancient cultures mark these sites. He personally is convinced that these are anomalous EM energies that various certain people in the general population, particularly temporal lobe instable individuals, and some 4% of the population is in fact temporal lobe instable. These people are extremely sensitive to electromagnetic variations. He thinks that these locations were picked up on by these people, that religious attributes were then given to these locations. Then the dolmen, the various stone circles, etc., were built to mark them. And this is how this whole thing evolved. Whether he's right or not, I don't know, but if you're interested in that sort of subject, this is his book, and it's available on Amazon.com. There's one other change in the growth habit, which I think is important. It has not been researched enough, mostly because nowadays everybody, all the farmers plant hybridized crop. But if you are, in fact, working with non-hybridized crop, which grows variously, grows at a varying rate all by itself naturally, what we found in the few formations that we've actually been able to work on that were not in hybridized crop was that this natural variation was completely altered in the crop circle seeds. We got exactly the same growth rate. It synchronized the growth rate, but formation itself did. A couple of quick points about bending. There are two kinds of bending in crop circle plants. There's bending at the base of the plant, and there's node bending. They're very different, and they need to be looked at differently. At the base of the plant, like this, the seeds are in rape, so it's very visible. They're significant. You see, that sort of bending, generally, it matters. That's important. These plants don't bend like that easily. They tend to snap and break. In very young, early green barley or wheat, they can bend to some extent, so you have to be careful there. But in crop like rape or in older crop, which does not bend without breaking, that bending at the base means something. A couple more examples of it. Node bending, on the other hand, you have to be very careful of. We're talking about this sort of thing. When you knock a plant down, as long as you don't kill it, if it's simply flattened, and particularly if it's young and vigorously growing, it will begin to reorient itself to the sun and to gravity. It's called gravitropism and phototropism. It's a completely natural process of the plant. And it begins right away. Within a day or two of being knocked down, the plants will do this. They do it much more vigorously when the plant is young. When plants are quite old, they don't do it very much at all. So what you need to know if you see node bending in a crop circle is, when did that crop circle occur? What was the growth stage of that crop when it occurred? How long has it been since it happened and you're there? In order to judge whether this is something that happened when the crop circle occurred, or whether it's due to the natural recovery processes of the plants. See, here again, this is what we're talking about, these nodes. Sometimes it is part of the formation situation, but frankly, I think in many, many cases, it is simply this phototropism or gravitropism. What I've noticed is that when I see a swath like this cutting through a formation and plants are going to the left and to the right as they are in this, that's usually part of the genuine circle formation energy situation. This is not what you usually see when it's phototropism or gravitropism. The plants tend to reorient straight up. But you need to be alert to that. And unfortunately, early on, a guy in England labeled all this magic bends. It drives me insane because that's the least magic thing of what's going on, actually. We did a control study to double test this particular idea, and the idea that had been raised by the debunkers that crop circles were simply due to over-fertilization. This is what was going on. So what we did was, in a farm in Maryland, we took two tracts of land. They were exactly the same, same width, same measurement, and had the farmer plant the field as he normally would, and then we over-fertilized one of those strips 100%. One of our field workers then carried out this situation where he made crop circles beginning early in the season, and he did it all summer long. This is one of his efforts. And here you see this node bending? This is within 3 days of, in very early stages, in June, of the making of a crop circle. This is already starting to reorient itself because of the phototropism and gravitropism. This is simply a chart that tells you.
We fired it up, and I was just blown away.
The degree of node bending as the time elapsed from when the formation was started. These are in early, flattened early in the season. But you can see at around 22, 23 days, you've got a massive increase in the node bending. And it starts fairly early on. So you do have to have your wits about you when you're evaluating node bending. All right, we're going to look at the fact that this happens in standing crop as well as in down. This formation was back in 93 at Churchill. And you see all this randomly bound stuff. Then a fairly organized thing here, and lots of little circles with standing centers. Many people would dismiss this, but what we have found over and over and over again is that some of these are much more interesting to look at than some of the more pristine ones. What we were interested in mostly in this formation and what we sampled were a lot of these circles with standing centers. They're quite small. Here's the sampling diagram, and you can see that we took, these are the five samples we took in each one of these circles, labeled here in red, that we actually sampled. We also took some samples along that long squiggly thing. Now, what we found consistently in these samples was the standing centers here showed node length increase absolutely compared to the controls. This is the standing plants in the centers. They also showed a loss, a decrease in seed weight. So the seeds were shrunken and they weighed less. And they showed a growth increase. So we had the node length changes, an increase, the seedling weight decreased, and the growth rate increased in these standing plants that had never been touched by anything. They clearly weren't flattened with a plank or a board. And I'm trying to impress that in your head so every time you hear pranks with planks, you have another idea in your mind. Furthermore, we have found in a number of cases, and this has not been, enough work has not been done here to make certain delineations, but we have looked at a number of randomly down crop events. Both those that have occurred with no organized geometric crop circle nearby and some that did have the real crop circle, the geometric ones nearby. This is a non-geometric up in Canada. And then in cases like this, where you have this just randomly down stuff near the main formation, what we have found fairly regularly is exactly the same changes in that area that we would find in the geometric formation itself. In fact, we find the changes to be greater, generally, if there is an attendant area like this. The changes in those areas in the plants are more severe. In this case, it's this sort of stuff that you see. And we find the same changes there that we do in the geometric. In a case in North Dakota that we just did last year, we have a thought bubble type formation. And we had definite changes inside the geometric event, but in the randomly down stuff nearby, the changes were double. The node length increase, the seedling weight, all of this was massively different, much more pronounced. What this indicates to us is that whatever is doing the crop circles either doesn't get it right all the time, or is, I mean, it's doing, both things are being done. Now, this doesn't mean that all randomly down crop has anything to do with crop circles, but sometimes it does. You can't just dismiss it because it's not geometric. Many times when I'm getting interviewed, I'm asked about, well, if crop circles were a real thing, particularly if they were a natural phenomenon, which Levingood was for a long time indicating he thought they were, how come they only happen in the middle fields? So I put in a couple slides in case there are people who want to see this. They don't happen just in the middle fields. Here's one that goes around some roads, another one that crosses a road, another which is crossing the boundary. There's two different crops in these fields. This doesn't happen all the time, but it happens often enough. They do cross boundaries. Furthermore, they occur in all kinds of plants, generally, of course, the cereal crops that we know about, but they occur in grasses. They occur in flowers, in this particular case in Germany. It's a field of flowers, very delicate flowers, in which the footsteps of the investigators were clearly visible once they had walked in the field. And this is the case in string beans that Robert and I saw happen. These are full-grown string bean plants, in carrots, in potatoes, Here we have a rapeseed crop circle and, of course, in corn. Also, I didn't put the slides in, but we have many of them in snow, where the snow is affected rather than the plants. You have snow on the ground, then the crop circle occurs. Another point that should be made, and this has not been studied properly and is one of the projects I very much want to do. Here we have two crop circles in a field. This one was here. This is the following year. A certain number of these, where the crop circle was, nothing grows the next year, in spite of the fact that the field has been tilled and plowed and seeded exactly the same. Everything grew fine here, but around this, where this one had been, nothing would grow, and that was for a couple of years. We get images like this also, which are sometimes due to heavy visitation by visitors who trample seed from the crop that's in the field that year into the ground, so much so that what happens the next year is that that old seed comes up with the new seed, creating a design where you can see pretty much where the old design was. That's sometimes the case. That is not always the case. We get events like this, where this does not seem to be, because this is the crop that was, this is the crop that was flattened, and so that may be the case in this, but nobody studied it to be sure. And then we have incredible situations like this, where here's the image. That was caused by the fact that the plants inside that crop circle, where the old one had been, were growing several inches taller and much greener, as you can see here. That's how come you can see that image. So there are a number of different reasons why you might see a ghost image, and it should be looked at much more carefully than it has been yet. The other major contribution of the early ELT work would be this discovery of a magnetic material in the soils at crop circles. Another event at Chur Hill, in which this was first discovered, this is a stalk of wheat taken from that, where the material was literally embedded. The material was molten when it hit the stalk and was embedded in that stalk, as many others. It was found melded on top of many of the chunks of soil. Here's one of these lovely little magnetite bubbles that we found under the microscope, clearly indicating that this material was in a molten state when it impacted the crop field. What Levengood and Burke decided they thought had happened here, this happened during the Perseid meteor shower, was that tiny little particles, microscopic particles of meteoritic dust, which are filtering to Earth all the time, but are more so during a meteor shower, had gotten caught up in this atmospheric plasma, which Levengood was proposing was causing the crop circles. Now, plasmas, when they spiral, emit microwaves. Plasmas also have these strange electrical pulses associated with them, and they're known to be associated with strong magnetic fields. A rotating plasma system, conceivably, might account for the physical changes that Levengood had been documenting. And in fact, that's what he thought had gone on in this particular event. We discovered further that in many crop circles, particularly subsequently when we started sampling soils regularly, that the same magnetic material, the same magnetic iron, was found, but in tiny little spherules in the range of 10 to 50 microns in diameter. This is a couple of our EDS guys. This is an examination that gives you the elemental constitution of whatever it is you're working on. In this case, the soils, the silicates, and here the iron. It's a very pure iron that we find. It's magnetized. No nickel, which you might expect in a meteoritic dust, but Levengood and Burke stick by their original idea. It's also important to notice that the material is not always in perfect spheres. A lot of it is, but some of it is only partially ablated, again indicating exposure to intense heat, at least briefly. Regardless of the origin of that material, there's another important point, and that is its distribution. Just like the node lengths, how they're distributed is almost as interesting as the original change. This is a 5 or 6 circle event in New York State, And what we found in this case, and this is looking at this magnetic material, was this is the center, and this is going out to the edge of the circle, of circle three. And here's the distribution in circle four. We then discovered that when we did the controls outside of one of the circles, look at this relationship as you go farther and farther away. This is the edge of the circle. Again, you have a more or less linear deposition of this material. That does not happen naturally. That indicates some sort of process, an organized process involved with that kind of deposition, whatever the material is. One of the things we've discovered since is that some of these particles, in fact, are, what do they call it, effluvia. Coal-fired power plants produce some of this material before the emission standards were in place that are here today. What this means is a lot of this stuff just sort of blanketing the entire Earth, actually. So it's distributed absolutely randomly, generally. It's the distribution here, that if this is nothing more than coal-fired effluvia, the distribution is, again, of great interest. In this formation in Canada, I'm going to show you this distribution here. We're looking at this part of the formation. Here's the sampling diagram. And look at this connection. This is the center of the circle. This is the edge. I mean, you don't get anything better than that. That's an absolutely linear deposition of, remember, microscopic particles. You can't see them. And yet the soil samples taken every 10 feet or whatever they were produce this result. This, in this particular case, indicates that the majority of the particles were distributed around the perimeter. This suggests centrifugal force, something rotating. However, it's not always the case, so you can't say that. I mean, it's not what you find in every single case. This is a slide just to remind me to briefly tell you that Levengood's published ideas or hypothesis has been this notion of an atmospheric plasma being responsible for the crop circle situation. This doesn't encompass everything he knows or thinks, but in order to publish, you have to come up with some sort of rationale. Based on his work alone, we're not talking about anybody else's, but on his work and the results he obtained with node length change, the expulsion cavities, the growth abnormalities, the stuff in the soil, all of those changes could, to some extent, be explained by exposure to a plasma discharge. Well, okay, a plasma we all know about is the Northern Lights. This is a relatively moderate plasma discharge. We also know that when plasmas spiral, they emit microwaves. They do, in fact, have these strong electrical fields and very unusual magnetic fields associated with them. This all fits with what we've been finding in the crop circles. Furthermore, as recently as 2003, a new plasma discharge was discovered in the atmosphere by astrophysicists at the University of Colorado. Pilots actually knew about this years before, but until the scientists actually see it, you know, they don't admit it's there. But blue jets were finally named and announced as discovered in 2003. So it's conceivable that there are plasma systems that have not yet been discovered by science, which maybe are responsible for the crop circle situation. It's interesting to note that in the laboratory, in plasma generated in the laboratory, the designs they produce when they're aimed at, say, a wall covered with dust, these are the designs they regularly, consistently produce. That's just a plasma discharge from a generated plasma in a lab. Well, these designs look a little familiar. Furthermore, we've noticed that the numbers of crop circles, not the intricacy, but the numbers, seem to correlate to some extent with sunspot solar flare activity, which is an 11-year cycle. In the years when there is the greatest, the strongest solar flare activity, you have the most numbers of crop circles. And there's a fairly good correlation between the two. What is a sunspot? What is the solar flare activity? It's plasma coming out as full tilt boogie. So again, there's a suggestion that there's some connection there. And finally, in that regard, this is southern England, where it happens to be on the most porous rock known to mankind, chalk. when the surface water percolates down through the chalk, an electrical charge is created at the ground. John Burke and I have measured this electrical charge over several summers, and what we found was that as the summer goes along and the water table drops, the electrical charge at the surface increases, and it increases enough so that conceivably it could function as an attractor to an atmospheric plasma system. It happens to be the case that in many other parts of the world where crop circles occur, there will be a limestone substrata, and limestone is the next most porous rock. So perhaps, you know, this again, this is a very, beginning investigatory thing. This is not fully documented yet, but it's an idea which might want to be followed up. And finally, about the designs, they are, of course, the thing that hang everybody up. Levengood points out, and this is from a paper that he published in Nature in 1966, I believe, long before he was involved in crop circles. He was here discussing something known as vortex instability, which is a factor in forming designs in air and in water. You take a little bit of a clay, which is a different color, and you introduce it into water and give it a swirl, and all sorts of designs emerge. We don't think of this as anything abnormal when we see it on that side, but when we see it in the field, we immediately assume something very different is going on. Here's another one of these tests where he introduced a little driblet of clay into an absolutely still medium and then photographed it as it descended. Every time it does it, it creates different patterns. If you look in particular at some of these, and then you look at a few crop circles, you can certainly see a similarity. God, those slides are getting all beat up. Here we have, this is a diagram of electron velocities. This would be the microscopic scale. And of course, you see crop circles that mimic that same design. We look at a sunflower seed head, and we don't think anything abnormal or peculiar is going on. And yet, when we see a similar design like that, we immediately assume that it's something sensational. Now, the point I'm trying to make there is that when you're approaching this sort of thing, it's wise to consider the natural processes first before you jump to some other conclusion. There's a lot of evidence in thermodynamics to suggest that a large majority of the patterns that occur in crop circles could form completely spontaneously once a certain series of events have been initiated. You must also remember that many of the more elaborate designs occur in England, where, in fact, we know that a lot of them are man-made. Without testing each formation, I personally have no way of knowing whether that formation is man-made or not. And therefore, trying to decide whether the design means anything seems pointless until I know whether the formation is real. If it's man-made, well, then it's somebody's idea. All right, that said, the most exciting new work in the crop circle world is this. In Logan, Utah, in the mid-90s, this gal, who's a geologist, went to visit the formation which had occurred in Logan because she read our papers, was curious about if we were right at all about heat being present. Her particular expertise was clay minerals, and her thesis was on the effects of heat on clay minerals. Well, we're talking about heat, so she's thinking maybe there's a change in the clay minerals in crop circle soils. She did a little work herself, which indicated that we should do a further study. If you look, this is that formation on the ground, and you'll see that that does not look like the typical elegant lay that you're always told about in the British crop circles. A lot of them look like this, actually, on the surface, and many of them that look like this are highly interesting in the lab. She used a technique known as X-ray diffraction. You extract the clay minerals from the soil first. You put it on a mount. It's stuck in a machine that bounces X-rays off the sample. Those X-rays, if they bounce off the sample, produce a graph, which we're looking at here. I don't know quite how the material science guys that do this, in this case, a man
trying to run audio in
Sam Iyengar from California. I don't know how they know which peak is the one we're wanting to look at, but they know. And what they do is they measure these peaks, in this case the Oerlikon-Smectite peaks. They measure them at half height, the width. And that produces a number called the Kubler index. That indicates the degree of crystallization of the sample. So it's the width of this peak at half height, simply gives you a figure, which then indicates how crystallized that sample is. She did this, and she found in the sample she took in Logan what she believed was a difference in the crystalline structure, an increase. Now, if that could be proven, that is a very strong argument, if in fact it could be proven. She didn't do enough tests. It's very expensive. And it was at this point that Lawrence Rockefeller came into our lives and eventually gave us the funding to carry out exactly that study on this formation in Edmonton, Canada. Here's just a photograph of it. This is a composite because we didn't have an aerial. And again, notice the lay, very much like that one in Logan. This is in barley, and you'll see there's Canadian thistle all through this field. Canadian thistle is vicious. No one in their right minds would go into a field with this stuff in it and make a crop circle because you get torn to shreds. At any rate, this is a diagram that shows you the lay. Very interesting radial lays in these circles. And this one shows you better. We had, again, this ring going around the outside, very slender in the very bottom, a radial lay covering that, and then it was completely chaotic stuff on top of that. And here's a sampling diagram for the large circle. We also sampled these two. You can see we're doing many diameters there. It's a lot of samples. And what we did was we sampled a hunk of plants, about 15 plants per sample, at each one of those actually, I'll show you, at each one of those locations. Every single one of these is a sample. And around the base of those plants, we took surface soil, the top half inch of soil, about a cupful. So that's what was done at every single one of those locations and also in these two circles. What we found was the following. Levingood did his standard plant work, and here we have five plants on the left, which are from the formation five controls here. This is the apical node, massively elongated, and also we have some expulsion cavities, which is very rare in the apical node. And this was the first formation in which we had seen in cereal crops, every single node blown all the way down. Every single node in the sample plants were blown over and over again. The controls, as you see, are over here. These are the apical nodes, the penultimate, and the third. So we had the plant results that we expect we regularly see. Here we're looking at, this is node lengths. So here we have the controls. The circle A, which is the smallest circle, the medium-sized circle, and the largest. Notice that the node length changes were the most extreme in the smallest circle. That's typical of what we see. The smaller parts of these, you have a multi-circle event, and you want to feel the energy go into the small part. That's where you're going to feel, if you can feel it at all, that's where you're going to feel it. The changes are almost always more extreme in the smaller parts of any given formation. Here's Dr. Iyengar at the XRD machine. Because I wanted this study to be untainted, I chose people who had the right credentials, who were completely respected in their fields, and particularly people who had never heard of crop circles. Dr. Iyengar didn't have the faintest idea what a crop circle was. I knew that he had the capability, the competency to do the work. I knew his equipment was properly calibrated, that he was properly registered with the state, et cetera, and the man had never heard of crop circles. All he did, he was mailed the soil samples. It was his job to extract the clays, put them on mounts, and put the mounts in this machine, and then give us the results. That's what he did. He didn't have to know what crop circles were. It didn't matter. All he had to do was do that work, and he did. And he produced, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of these graphs and gave us the printed results also. And these are the KIs in two different conditions. Now, once we have the data, What we had to do was to find a statistician, and I wanted somebody completely separate, again with all the right credentials, and again, if possible, who had never heard of crop circles. And I found this man. He'd been at MIT, and a friend of mine there recommended him. And he had the right credentials, had the right background, was entirely competent, and he also had never heard of a crop circle. He was simply given the data and told, we asked him some questions, and the first question I asked was, is there a difference in the crystalline structure between the clays from inside the circle and the clays outside? Very straightforward question. His answer was, yes, there was, and it was at the 95% level of confidence. This actually amazed me, because from the original data, we thought we didn't have a result. Sam and I were both quite surprised. I then went to another statistician and had it repeated by a separate guy altogether and got exactly the same answer. So right off the bat, we know that the clay minerals inside those crop circles were better organized, were more ordered, greater crystallinity than were the controls outside. And this was at the 95% level of confidence. In other words, yes, there was a change in the crystalline structure. The next question, and this absolutely blew me away, was about these node lengths. I wanted to know, were the changes in the plants occurring at precisely the same locations as the changes in the soils? And so that was the next question asked. The result was yes, at the 99.2% level of confidence. It literally never gets any better than that. What that means is that whatever caused the changes in the plants almost certainly caused the changes in those clays. This, however, raises a big problem. The kind of energy it would take to cause the changes in the clays would have either obliterated the plants by pressure or incinerated them immediately because of the heat. And obviously that wasn't the case. The plants were intact. This is the chart showing the relationship to from the plants and the clay minerals, the regression analysis. I could hardly believe that the result was so good. I just, oh my God, I can't believe we've got this. I was lucky enough to get the help of a world-famous clay mineralogist. And in fact, he was head of the Department of Earth Sciences at Dartmouth, a head of the Mineralogical Society of America, the guy who writes the textbooks on clay mineralogy, and in particular, the X-ray diffraction technique. He was at Dartmouth then. And I took all this up to him and asked for his opinion. I thought we could hardly believe our eyes, and I knew nobody was going to believe us if we didn't have an authority of his ilk. And much to my amazement, he agreed to go ahead and look at the material. He first said, well, it can't be. This is insane. This can't happen. So he asked for all the mounts. Then he redid the work, put them in his XRD machine. He got exactly the same results. Then he asked for all the statistical work. I gave that all to him, and he redid that. And lo and behold, he came up with exactly the same result. So here we are with one of the world's authorities on clay minerals and the X-ray diffraction technique, admitting, saying in public, and writing it down eventually, that yes, in fact, you know, we had this result. His wife told me on the phone one night that he had been talking to his son, who was a geologist also, and she overheard him say about us, I wonder if they know what they've got. Meaning the result was absolutely astounding to him. And when it's a man of that ilk, you have to know you actually do have something. A change in the crystalline structure of the clays at precisely the same locations where we had changes in the plants, the typical plant changes.
The soil had changed too.
The clays in the soils had altered. The problem being, the astounding part of it is that we're talking about microwave radiation or something of that ilk causing the plant changes, and we're talking about temperatures in the range of 1300 degrees C for hours to cause the clay mineral changes.
In other words, it's hoax proof. Nobody could do that.
Nobody that we...
Of this plant.
Nobody we know. So, just to be sure, because he was putting his name on this, He asked us to do this glycolation test. This is, he thought, maybe there's a situation where you have interstitial water. We're talking of literally atoms layered, if this is what we're looking at. And he's thinking that perhaps interstitial water could account for this difference. So he had us do the glycolation experiments. That produced no result. That was not the answer. And then, because Diane, the original geologist, had suggested that she thought microwaves might be responsible, he asked us to go ahead and microwave some of our control samples, which we then did. It did not produce the result. Microwaves were not what caused the changes in the clay minerals. And this is the letter that he produced for me, saying that our work was competent and that the result, in his opinion, was genuine. And boy, did I feel good to get that letter. It tickled me half to death. Okay, time for a break, and then we come up back with the boy from Holland and some of this other stuff. I'm not going to go at great length into this cattle thing. Mostly, I want to simply highlight one result that has been obtained. Would you all be quiet?
Giving me a wave.